This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/acast. That's burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Hello everybody, welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
And only Josh Brown, because James Dawes once again has been hampered by technology this week, just not able to get his computer working whatsoever. Man's had to go home, and we had to hit the recording slot, so here we are.
That's what he always says. That man skives more than I did at university. I don't believe any of these excuses for a second. Who doesn't have a computer is all I'm going to say.
Well,
at
man,
the
I
office.
Think- I have that thing. I've had that thing where you try and go in for a nice, lovely day's work, and you can't get something goes wrong, and it snowballs, and then 3 hours pass, and you're like, I just hate my entire life. I'm going home, and so I think he's mid transit right now on the way back home. But we need to hit a recording slot, so it's just me and thee. But we thought we'd have a conversation on the idea of, you know, which video games are the best first time through. Because shout out to What Culture Wrestling's Michael Sidgwick, who's currently going through Zelda Breath of the Wild, and keeps messaging us with all of his first time experiences, all the different things in that game that are just brilliant the first time you stumble upon them, and you know, we're sort of vicariously living through him, and we thought we'd do this conversation on which video games are the best first time through, and you know, sort of pointing at the idea of like some of the best games of all time, but maybe you don't want to revisit them because they nail their sort of, you know, openings, endings, whatever their structure overall. And I already know that I'm going to say that, like, because we have three picks each, and I know that I'm going to say stuff, and then you're going to say that you played them five times over and you've got the platinum and you can't wait to play it again. But we'll get there. I want to have a little opening conversation on gameplay loops, monetization loops, where the industry's at, how we've sort of moved away from narrative, and how it's almost a miracle if something actually prioritizes its story. But do you have any preference? Like, that was kind of my opening thing, was just, do you prefer games or experiences that can end? Or do you like the idea of something in a game space having like endless loops that you can go back to, and it's just there, you can sort of tap back into it, like a Rocket League or something like that?
Scott Telford, you know me as a man who will rarely watch a television show unless it has an ending, so I think I can say...
You could have put full stop after television show. That would have been that.
That's very true. No, I do like an ending. I prefer an ending. It's not that I'm against games that go on forever, as I've talked about ad nauseum. Call of Duty Warzone is one of my favorite gaming experiences ever, and that is the thing that is just going to live forever until the servers are shut off, and it's up to you to decide when to end it. But yeah, overall, I'm kind of after something that feels complete. You know, the idea of completion, I think, in general, has kind of started to go away in games at the moment in favor of live services that, like you said, exist forever. But yeah, generally, I'm after something that I can put away and then potentially revisit in a couple years' time. But to something I can say that I finished and completed.
Yes, well, that's the thing, because I think it was just this week came out that God of War Ragnarok is 40 hours to 100% it, or to try and see everything, but about 20 hours for the main story. And I went, brilliant, perfect. I'm actually going to be able to see that. Like, I'm actually going to be able to get through that. It's not aiming for a 200, 300 hour slog where it's just grindable stuff over and over and over again. I like a nice, tight, short game. In fact, it's one of the reasons that I really like Metal Hellsinger, because I can as you've, I mean, I might argue that game's a bit too short considering it starts to hit its stride and then it's over, but still you can replay those levels, you can get better at them, there's different goals, there's different arcade things to hit. I like a nice as a sentence, I like a nice tight experience, Josh Brown, and I think that
really?
Sometimes I really do on an afternoon, it's 20 past 2 in the afternoon, and I think that sometimes that can be way more preferable than just an endless thing. I get the whole value for money side of it, but there's something about knowing that it has an end to it, like it's a bookend, like you're going to close the final chapter and know that that part of your life is done, and maybe you'll choose to replay it as opposed to just never getting there, and having that idea of things replicating themselves for so long that there's almost a miniature idea of replaying it over and over and over again before you even hit the credits because of how many things you're doing over and over, you know, the same activity over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's like a really interesting idea, and you know, I just think in the kind of culture that we live in right now, not just in the realm of video games, but we have so much vying for our attention. We always did, but now that everything is streamable, everything is, you know, accessible at our fingertips, you know, we've got, I mean, if young Josh knew how many video games he had access to at the click of a button, he would lose his tiny little head. You know, right now, we've just got so much to play. We've got so many games on our two playlists, so many things to watch, so many TV shows for me to avoid that I, one of the first things I do before playing a game right now is head to howlongtobeat.com and kind of figure out how much time I'm going to have to dedicate to it. And it's kind of like the length of games dictates my two playlist more than it ever did in years prior.
Totally. The thing is, I was on the Xbox the other day, and I just, one of their tiles on the dashboard was way too many games, ? And I was like, yes, Xbox, you're doing this. You're the one giving me a full, you know, 10-course meal every month, whilst I'm still feasting on the previous month. But I feel like, yeah, even they are very, very much aware of it. And obviously, we've got the statistics for Game Pass this week that it's making $2.9 billion. So it's not going to be going anywhere anytime soon. But yeah, I just think that idea of, over time, stories sort of going by the wayside. I feel like stories in gaming kind of came from, you know, Kojima and Metal Gear Solid, then the next evolution was Naughty Dog and Uncharted, and then you sort of got The Last of Us, where it refined things off and matured things, and 2013 sort of elevated the medium, and you sort of got this other side to gaming that was way more introspective and complex and emotionally resonant, or whatever. Some of them weren't games in between them, but I sort of looked to them as some of the milestones, and then I feel like across the 2010s, it all went away, and it became more arcadey again, and the 8th generation was just doubling down on, okay, what can we give you that's a 5-minute loop, and then how can we replicate that and monetize it? And it was kind of like a return to the arcade mentality. One of the earliest podcasts that we ever did was, you know, is the idea of a story in a video game a fad because they were in all of a sudden across the 2000s? And do we need them, let's say? And like, I think that's interesting. And it's like, I think where we're at now, you've got PlayStation doubling down on story stuff and Jim Ryan talking about, you know, one of the most valuable aspects of PlayStation is their single player stories. And if anything, they're just trying to expand the story side of it with how big their IPs are becoming, like the Horizon movie and everything else. But yeah, what do you think of that stuff, where the industry's at right now in regards to story prioritization?
And for me, you know, definitely I agree with what you said there about in the 2010s, especially once the indie space properly started to blow up, where you had, you know, mechanical focused games, everyone, I think, kind of realized that, you know, well, maybe gameplay is king, and that kind of discourse came to the rose to the top of the pile in a way that it wasn't necessarily in the late 2000s or even early 2000s. However, I will say that I don't think it's just because stories have maybe been minimized in some of the biggest AAA games that we kind of get these experiences that, you know, last forever or prioritize loops. I think it's kind of like the difference in how campaigns just are structured from a gameplay perspective. Like, I remember going back to Metal Gear Solid 1 a few years ago, which you mentioned there, and I was shocked at how little just kind of base stealth you do in that game. And what I mean by that is kind of just being in a room with a bunch of guys and having it be up to you whether you want to take them out or whether you want to sneak through. Like, there are some levels like that, but that game is so set piece heavy. You know, you're moving from one distinct gameplay kind of zone to the next, and it's punctuated by kind of like those more general gameplay sections where you're just doing like the core stealth or now and again. But I was shocked at how much variation was in there compared to games now, where, like you said, you know, you do kind of get a 5 to 10 minute loop, and then that's more or less the whole game. Yeah, you can change it up with different objectives, but you kind of, you get your gameplay sort of base, and then that it's things added on top of that. It's not swapping the base out for another meal, if that makes sense. That analogy was quite bad, but I hope
that totally works. I think for me it's like that difference between skill trees being actual abilities that you'd unlock and skill trees being plus 5% to your attack, and it's the same animation but now it does more damage. Like, that for me is the most boring way to progress in a game. Like, I get that sometimes that's just raw RPG stuff, but it depends how it's implemented, like per game. But I always love a good ability tree. I love the ability that I love the ability to get proper abilities in games, so I can unlock a move, you know, 30 levels later that I didn't have at the beginning. I feel better as a player. I like the idea of things being inside you as well, abilities that you didn't know your character had. And like, I'm playing through Mario Sunshine at the minute, and there's like extra abilities that Mario has that, as far as I've done so far, I'm like 10 levels in. The game hasn't tutorialized at all, but it's like, oh, if you flick the analog stick and then jump, you'll do a pirouette. And then if you do the like, you've got this like water cannon thing, if you do that whilst you're spinning, you'll do this big shower attack. And it's like, well, that's really cool that I didn't know was in there. That in itself is really rewarding. We should pivot into our specific choices for this, because I think they'll just be threaded throughout the conversation in general of the games that nail this like ramp up and progression and feeling of progress, and that do it best. So what would you like to lead with?
Scott Telford, I'm going to lead with a game that I know you love, and that's The Outer Wilds, because The Outer Wilds, to me, is the peak game. If we're talking about, you know, what is the game that you would like to erase from your memory and experience fresh? To me, it's going to be The Outer Wilds every single time. And interestingly, at least for me, it's not because of the story. It's because of your understanding of the game mechanics. You mentioned Mario there, and having, you know, these systems built within the game that aren't tutorialized, that you just kind of figure out for yourself, and you feel like you've unlocked something. You've unlocked another part of the game. You've unlocked a bit of knowledge that you didn't have. And for me, The Outer Wilds, which if you don't know, is a game all about space exploration. You are someone going into space for the first time, and after 20 minutes pass, the sun explodes, and you find yourself back on the planet you set off from, and you need to keep doing these 20-minute loops over and over again to kind of figure out what the hell's going on. And ultimately, on top of that, figure out the entire universe and how it works, because every planet you visit is different. It has completely different rules in terms of its physics, in terms of its geography, all of that stuff, yet they're all connected, yet because it's, you know, a galaxy, each kind of thing in that galaxy complements something else, and it's up to you to kind of make what's is initially literally a universe of possibilities small and knowable. And it's because you have to ultimately know the universe in totality. That's why I would never get the same experience playing it again, because you know those mysteries. And the whole appeal of the game is understanding those mysteries and gaining knowledge and understanding not only the story, but just kind of how everything works and how everything fits together. It makes you feel smart as hell when you have that knowledge, but one of the best experiences is not knowing what you're doing and just coming up with your own hypotheses and then trying them out, seeing if they work, if they don't, going back to the drawing board. I'm not smart enough to be a scientist, but this game has made me feel like a scientist, and I would love to experience that again, but I couldn't if I played the second time.
And what you could play, and this isn't one of my three picks, but it reminds me that everything with Outer Wilds, because I cannot for the life of me get Outer Wilds. I've played it like four times. I never enjoy any of it, and I just bounce off it, whatever. I know somewhere in there is a great game, and I've landed on a few different planets. And the thing that I do love about it is that each planet kind of has its own rule set, like, you know, its own rules. Like, sometimes they're visually based, sometimes they're physics based, sometimes they're like optical illusions almost. Depends what it is. And then, like you said, once you've figured that stuff out, you've figured it out, and you'll be arriving on that planet knowing what to look for and whatever. All of that reminds me of The Witness, where or Jonathan Blow's work in general. Once you know how Braid functions, you'll get it. Like, you know what the rule of time is for that level. And then figuring out how time can function differently in Braid was it was its own brain-breaking thing. And then for him to do that again in The Witness, I don't think you've played The Witness.
No.
But that is easily one of my favorite games of all time. It wouldn't be on my list for what I'm going for in terms of the three games that I've picked here. But massive shout out to The Witness. That game is all about, let's say, cognitive expansion, and once you realize, you know, what rules they're playing with, and once you speak that, it's literally a language. Like, The Witness is a language, and you're learning it the whole way through. And then once you can speak that language, you see right through the game. And then towards the end of it, they gamify the fact that they know that they're speaking to you, and it's like, that's incredible. Like, that is next level genius. Like, yeah, The Witness is phenomenal, and I think Outer Wilds and The Witness feel like they are quite similar. I would still totally recommend The Witness to everybody. And like, yeah, and I managed to finish The Witness, thankfully, whereas Outer Wilds I just couldn't get a foothold on. But
these Sorry, I was just going to say, continue. Finish your point, Scott Telford. I don't want to.
No. I was going to throw in one of my way tier examples of what I was going for in terms of what a game that's incredible first time through means. But you should say your thing, and then I'll throw mine in.
Let me butt in then, because it does continue what you said there. Because again, going off with our conversation with Michael Sidgwick, which inspired this podcast from this morning, you know, he was talking about something similar. Oh my God. Talking about, you know, playing Breath of the Wild and acquiring this knowledge and how it's just kind of fun to learn a game systems and come to grips with the environment and the character that you're embodying. And I do think that most of the games that I've picked for this list and most of the games that I would rank amongst the most fondest gaming experiences that I've ever had feel like an education, feel like you're being taught, feels like you've expanded, like you said, you've expanded your brain, you've expanded your understanding of what video games can even be, or especially the player space that you're playing within. And that's just, it's really, really difficult to nail those games, and I've only ever played like a handful of them, but when they get it right, they lead to these conversations, they lead to you thinking about them all the time, and they resonate in a way that, you know, an Ubisoft 50-hour, 5-minute gameplay loop just can't even come close to, in my opinion.
Well, that's the thing, right? Like, I miss these kinds of conversations, or the conversations that we were having this morning with Sidgwick, or anyone who's going through the likes of Breath of the Wild, where it's like, oh my God, have you seen this yet? Have you tried this area of the map yet? Have you held this button down while you did this? And it's like, some of that stuff can feel like spoilers. Obviously, you don't want to give away specifics, but that idea of there's more to this game and you haven't seen it yet, versus in Ubisoft's case, and even in Far Cry 3, it was like, well, have you done a settlement yet? Have you beaten this boss yet? It's like, well, yes, and you beat them in the same way that I did. Like, there's like small amounts of variations in terms of maybe how you were taking out NPCs and settlement or something, but the realization in Breath of the Wild's case that Link has a much, much bigger moveset than you think he does at the beginning, and just, you know, realizing you can aim in slow motion if you just aim in midair, or whatever it is. Like, I think that stuff is it comes to you and you realize that you're becoming the hero over time. I'll throw in just alongside this that Breath of the Wild was going to be my, like, quote unquote number one. I think that's the ultimate hero's journey monomyth style perfect game that I just drank in across 2017 and absolutely adore. I think it's possibly the best game of all time. Like, it's up there. Like, it just absolutely is. And it has that transcendent quality where it taps into something where it's like you're on the journey with Link. You are Link. You're figuring stuff out. You're thinking in a way that replicates Link. I'm just throwing that in as one of my three, but what were you going to say?
I can't remember, but I would just echo what you said there about Breath of the Wild, because I also left that off my list because I thought you were going to include it, but we might as well talk about it here, because I do think that is also, you know, one of, if not the apex of this entire thing, because I said to Sidgwick this morning, you know, I've been chasing the high that Breath of the Wild gave me in 2017 for the past 5 years, because like you mentioned, you know, you embody this character, and just as you would in real life, you're kind of figuring out what you're literally capable of, and it's not through unlocks, it's not through stats, it's rarely even through, you know, actual power-ups that you get in game. It's just about what items do you have at your disposal, what does the environment dictate, and what can I physically do? And sometimes that's all you need to create a game that produces individual stories that you can then, you know, go to work, go see your friends, and then talk about. You know, no one gets through that game the same two ways. I didn't even know you could ride your shield as a sledge until I had finished it and talked to you about it, you know, because it has all of these secrets, and it's ultimately kind of up to the player how they navigate the world, and, you know, in it allows them to indulge in what they find interesting and exciting.
Well, I love that, like, Sidgwick was saying that he's currently struggling with a lot of the, I feel what they're actually called, the sentries. They're sort of like spider sentries. They have like laser blasts. Figuring out how to parry them, like, get the timing right. It's all to do with, like, when they flash just before they fire, it's like an instant blast thing, but you can't parry them. And any shield can parry. It's just that the weaker the shield, the tighter the window. And it's just like realizing that, again, like, everything that you need is in you. Even if you just pick up a really basic wooden shield, you can still deflect this insane laser blast. You just have to get the timing right. And it's like, for me, it's the perfect type of progression, or it's the perfect type of leveling up or whatever, because you're getting better as a gamer, as a player, as a understanding that space. And even if you're just like, I need some health, let me look around my surroundings. Oh, there's a few apples in those trees. I'm going to climb up that tree. I'm going to cut some apples down. I'm going to eat them, or I'm going to cook them. Or like the first time you realize that, you know, if you cut a tree down and then you get some flint and you just like strike it with a weapon and it makes a spark and a flame and you've just made a bonfire. And if you need to make some shelter, you can put a log over you as well in between two different things and just sit there and be like, I've just done this myself. I've just made shifted about a Dark Souls bonfire. Things like that, that I guess, like, you know, people are going to want to stumble onto, and going through that game, realizing just how many systems were in there that were emergent. So few games do that.
I'm completely breaking the structure of this whole podcast, but I just find this whole thing really interesting because I'm playing through The Last of Us Part 2 right now, as I keep talking about, but I promise it's really relevant this time. And the thing that I love about that game, and the thing that I love about a lot of Zelda games, is that it makes the puzzle, it doesn't dumb the puzzles down, but it makes the puzzles often revolve around common sense. So the first time in The Last of Us Part 2, for instance, that you realize you can just smash a window next to a locked door and jump through it, feels like revelatory, because you're kind of playing a game, thinking about game rules, and not every game allows you to smash a window. Not every game allows you to jump over a chest-high wall, even though you should be able to, because there are invisible barriers and you're playing within, you know, a restrictive game space. You're not playing within a real world. But I think
Quick to add into that, there's one bit where you're playing as Ellie, I forget which specific part of the city you're in, but you go upstairs. I was exploring every inch of that game the second time that I went through it, and it's like you're exploring for like collectibles and everything, and there's one bit where you can break a window and you can see like sort of like the overhang of like what used to be like a billboard or something, and you can see another office around the corner, and if you throw the rope at the right angle, you can make a swing and you can jump out, grab the rope and swing to the next office. I wish they did way more of that, because I feel like that stands out as the one time they do that, but that feeling of like, oh, I'm interacting with the physics of this in a really unique way. I love that. And like I said, I wish Naughty Dog would do more of that going forward.
100%. And that's just what I love, because, you know, in real life, hopefully, I will never be lost in the woods with, you know, the need to make a fire. But in Breath of the Wild, I can live that out, and I can live that out in a way that makes sense within my brain. I think it's a testament to how cartoony Breath of the Wild is, and how, you know, simplistic a lot of its quote-unquote realistic gameplay designs are. Like you said, you know, you just strike it and then a fire works, but it makes sense on a kind of common sense level, and I love that in games. That to me is so much more interesting than, you know, a game giving you an elemental, you know, bullet that kind of freezes people. That can be fun. But it's often more fun to kind of take more quote-unquote mundane things and do something interesting with them.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
Plus that elemental bullet, you know, by the end of the game, it's doing 5,000 more damage than it did before, but it still freezes them in the same animation. It still does the same, has the same application. Maybe the numbers go up a little bit, which is just a little bit boring. And we end up playing a spreadsheet in the background of everything. I'm going to throw in another one here, and then we'll go back to you. My other one that I was going to initially lead with was Red Dead Redemption 2, which is just a macular, you know, because the thing is, my whole sort of criteria for this was games that are journeys, games that feel like they're done, games that I don't want to touch again because the first time through them needs to be almost cemented and crystallized and left alone. I remember when David Cage first said about Heavy Rain, it was just that whole idea of the first time through that game, whatever choices you made, even if your Ethan drank the juice from the fridge in the morning before going to do the rest of that game, that was your story and you should never replay it. And he would always encourage people to not replay his games back then, which I always liked the idea of. And it depends on what the reason is that you might want to replay it, but something like Red Dead Redemption 2 is such a weighty, you know, sort of elephantine experience. Like, you are lumbering through that game to get to the end of it, and there are like spikes of like levity and action and everything, but when I got to the end of it, it was like a big dusty tome that I was like closing, and I was just like, that was like phenomenal and incredible. And I went back and forth on the end of it, and for me personally it didn't really work because it didn't necessarily register what my character was doing the whole time through, but there were so many highs and it was rendered so well and portrayed so well that I lived that life. Like, I lived a life and things happened at the end of that game and that life was done, and so I'm not going to resurrect and go back to that because it's done. But I don't know if you have the same thing, because I would also transplant that across to something like The Last of Us. Not that that ends in the same way, but they feel done, and because they're weighty, they take up my time, they're emotionally draining. That's a quality that I go to if I'm thinking about things that are best first time through.
What I like about this podcast, just to, you know, pat ourselves on the back, is that we both have come away with like slightly different conclusions as to what, you know, constitutes a game that we would only play through once. Because Red Dead Redemption 2, two nights ago, I was considering playing through for the third time, Scott Telford, because I love that game so much. I've played it twice through to completion.
Right. I will say that after I beat it, what I wanted to do was get back to, I think it's the third chapter in that game where everything is open to you, but you're, you have all the camp upgrades and everything's optional and whatever. You don't have that much of a story impetus to do stuff because the camp is ticking over. Dutch has got his plan, but nothing's implemented yet. And I love that feel. So there was a time back in 2018 after I finished, well, maybe it was 2019, because I would have given it some time, where I went back and I just got back to that chapter so I could just live in the idyllic sort of cowboy sim wing of that game. But it wasn't about replaying the story. It wasn't about any of that. I was skipping cutscenes. I was just getting back to, let me get it. But I already played through it because I was like, let me get back to that chapter. I just want to live that midpoint for a bit before everything goes sideways.
I totally get that. I have the opposite experience because I've played through Red Dead Redemption 2 twice, like front to back each time, 80 hours each, and loved it just as much the second time through, because I similarly, though, had a bit of trepidation the second time around because my first experience with that game felt so personalized, and Arthur felt like he had an experience that only I gave him, because obviously the cutscenes mostly play out the same, but what you do in like chapter 3 or whatever can be different from player to player. What you kind of find interesting and what you pursue will be slightly different, even in how your Arthur looks will be radically different going from person to person.
Like a young James Hetfield in my eyes.
I'm sure he did. But the second time through, I agree that Red Dead Redemption 2 is a big dusty tome, but it's one of the best big dusty tomes I've ever played. And the story was so rich and so full of, you know, warmth and character and pathos that I just needed to experience that again. And it's kind of, conversely to you, the story and how strong it is and how strong a sense of being in that world you gain from playing the game, that means I will replay that game forever. Like, I will returning to it. Not often, you know, not every year or whatever, but I will keep thinking about it, and I will want to... It'll be one of those kind of key texts that I want to keep re-experiencing.
Replay it mentally. Yeah, like, I think about it a lot. I think about replaying it. I remember all the what it felt like to play that game, and I get all warm and fuzzy inside thinking about it, but I'm not actually going to download the 100 gigs and go do it all again. Like, it's, I like that it's done. I like that I went through that experience, and it sort of gets to live on the side kind of thing. What was your second, or what was your next pick?
My second one was Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain.
Ooh,
and this is actually a game that I think I've mentioned before, that I have tried to replay so many times.
Right.
I have played the opening hour of this game genuinely 4 or 5 times, but I've only ever gotten past that once. And it's kind of crazy because that's when things open up and that's when I should have been involved. But there's something so intimidating about Metal Gear Solid 5, and maybe it's because of how wonky the second half is. You know, it's, you know, notoriously unfinished. You have to repeat a lot of missions. The story gets incredibly fragmented. Maybe knowing that is what puts me off kind of sticking with it for the full 50 hours. But I just don't know what it is about that game. And maybe this will make for a boring podcast, because I want to replay it. My head is saying yes, but every time I get to the point where I actually commit to it, my heart just says no, and I don't know
why. It's that opening bit. The thing is, you know how good Metal Gear 5 gets, and you know what it's like to have all those unlocks and all those different, like, not necessarily abilities, but you do almost get abilities because of how varied the gadgets become and all the different distraction items and whatever it is, attaching balloons to a Jeep and making it fly off and everything. I had the exact same thing where I was like, I want to get back to that. It was one of the only games where I've wished for DLC, and I've wished for the most soulless DLC. Just give me areas that I can have fun in with these abilities and these weapons and these items and everything. And obviously they never did it because, like you said, the development was all over the place and the story itself was so fractured by the end. But I just wanted more of that game. I could have played that forever. Like, I love my time with Phantom Pain. It's one of those ones that's over 120 odd hours in it where I just did everything, and I thought I always wanted more of that. Like, ironically, I still wanted more of it, but that beginning bit is nothing like that. It's way more belabored. It takes forever to get going. I guess you could skip cutscenes if you wanted to or whatever, but there's still a lot of, like, making you crawl through a hospital and, like, whatever. And you just want to get back to that sweet spot you were in, what, like 40, 50, 60 hours later? Even though it's all very, very solid after that anyway, there is a sweet spot that takes hold and runs after, like, a few hours in, but it definitely takes place after that opening bit.
Absolutely.
Because that's what puts me off too.
Yeah, like you said, you know, there is a sweet spot of that game where the gameplay loop is in your veins and it is the best thing you might have ever played. And good Lord, it's such a travesty that we didn't get more games made in the Fox engine, because it is smooth as butter. But yeah, it takes a long time to rank up because there's a lot of systems in Metal Gear Solid 5. Like, it's not a simplistic game. Like, it throws a lot at you, both from a story perspective and what you're doing. You know, you need to get an understanding of the mechanics. You need to get an understanding of what Mother Base is. You need to get an understanding of how you recruit people.
Thank
of how
God types.
Yeah, of how you take on side missions, of how you take on main missions. There's a lot of stuff in that game, and I think that's why it intimidates me going back to it, because I had a perfect 50-hour run with a run experience with that game initially, and I almost don't want that tainted the second time around.
That's fair. I will round up my side of things by saying, because you're on about, you know, getting more games made in the Fox engine, there's a lot of Metal Gear Solid 5's feel in my next game, which is Death Stranding, which is a game that is just... That game, I almost didn't... Because I beat it the first time, absolutely loved it, hated the end, thought the final sort of, whatever, hour-long cutscene, whatever the hell that ending was an absolute travesty, but I could not have enjoyed the rest of it more. And especially when we first went through it and having those conversations like we did with Breath of the Wild, where, oh my God, have you tried this yet? Have you done this? Have you seen this? Loved everything about that game. And it's the most simplistic thing. It's just a fetch quest game. But the way that they flesh that out, and they sort of treat the act of, like, firing a gun or jumping on a platform, you know, completing a fetch quest or whatever, that's your core thing, and you build it out from there. It's so good that when the director's cut came out, I jumped in that and just lost an entire afternoon. I felt like I blinked and 6 hours went by, and I was like, I can't do all this again. As enjoyable as the gameplay is and as perfect as that as those systems are, my first time through it was the first time I explored all those locations for the first time, and the first time that I had to improvise my way through them, where you're sort of going, okay, maybe I'll put a ladder up here, or maybe I'll put one of the 3D printed environment pieces or whatever, like a stunt ramp or a bridge or something, in here, and this is how I'm going to get to and from. And I made my own way across this place, and all the zip line stuff and all those feelings that you can't get back, like that. There's a bit near the end of the game where it's like, okay, now go back to the start, and you kind of realize that they're cashing in on how much you've paid attention and played the game until that point. And I mean, if you've done well, you can just zip line all the way back to the start again, or jump in your trusty bike and you know, use the highway and everything. So it's all those things that game, it's never going to be able to do again. The idea of everyone sort of asynchronously building together, because you can put crafting materials down and then someone else might finish a project while you're asleep or something, real you, not your character, and you'll go back the next morning and realize that things are further across. For me, you can't replicate that. Obviously, we'll get an expansion of it in Death Stranding 2, but exploring that game as like a fake community was the absolute best feeling ever.
The thing is, right, when I went to replay Death Stranding again, I suspected that I was going to think the exact same way as you. I didn't think I would finish it, because the first time through, like you said, there, so improvisational, and you're kind of coming to grips with what was at the time like a new style of game. Like, no one had really played anything like Death Stranding before. Yeah, it had like, you know, taken a lot of different elements from other games, but it kind of mixed them into its own uniquely Kojima stew. However, playing through the second time around, I realized that's kind of true. You're never going to have the exact same experience again, and it's never going to be as special as you bumbling down rivers, losing all of your packages, scraping through and feeling joyous that you got 1 out of 10 packages to the preppers or whatever. Mm-hmm. However, the second time around was definitely still worth it, and definitely still special in my opinion, because it was like, you know, going into a game as a professional rather than an amateur. Instead of just trying to get through the game this time around, I was trying to get 5 stars. I was trying to do everything as pristine as possible, as cleanly as possible, executing it like a professional. And that was an entirely different sense of joy and an entirely different sense of satisfaction that I didn't get the first time around. So if anything, I think I actually ultimately ended up enjoying my second time through Death Stranding even more, because I could bring the knowledge to the game and execute it virtually flawlessly. And, you know, it's still amazing when you do kind of mess up and you do have to scramble and you do have to improvise. But getting the platinum in that game the second time around was, to me, incredibly enjoyable. But they are very distinct experiences. You know, playthrough one and playthrough two, radically different styles of game almost.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's one of those things where, like, by the time you get to the end of it, and Death Stranding is a long game, like it's like 80 hours, even if you're largely mainlining stuff, but you can bring all those abilities in. It reminds me of like when I went back to Sifu, because I platinumed Sifu, but then when I went back to it for the DLC, they've added like bullet time and all these different costumes and everything. And although that muscle memory stuff is still in you, I know it's different to Death Stranding, but that idea of just sort of going back and wondering if you're still going to connect with it in the same way. And it's like, no, all these reference points are still in me. I'm still psychologically reacting to all these different things, and it's still enjoyable. What's your final pick, sir?
My final pick is The Return of the Obra Dinn, my friend.
Oh, what a beautiful, beautiful game.
An absolutely beautiful game. If you don't know, this is a puzzle title from a few years ago where you're essentially sent out to investigate a ship that has returned from the seas, and you have to figure out how every crew member died. You have to piece together everything. And again, it's a game about testing hypotheses. It's a game about, you know, just kind of trying to gain an understanding of an event. And it's another one of those games, consequently, that once you do understand what happened to everyone and the full story, that you can't replicate it. But the first time through that game was just chef's kiss, man. Like, that was such a such a novel idea, such a unique art style, such a gorgeous thing to experience.
That as well, like, Obra Dinn is the follow-up from, it's Lucas Pope's game. It was after Papers, Please. Because Papers, Please blew up, and that was part of the whole indie revolution thing in, like, 2012, 2013. But I feel like not as many people talk about Obra Dinn. I don't know if they were put off by the art style, because it does look like an old Apple computer rendering technique, which I really love. I love that it looks like dot matrix paper being printed over and over again to sort of get this look. But yeah, you've kind of, like, game mechanics-wise, you've got this, like, ghost book, this sort of supernatural book that you're using to catalog stuff, and you have this ability to sort of find different crew members and then use their experience experiences to recreate whatever happened on the ship, and you get their, I think you get their perspective. You fly around amongst everyone.
Yeah.
Like alongside. It's been a long time since I went through Uberdin, but I remember being so blown away by the rush of like, oh my God, I've got this guy's view on this thing. What were they doing before this? And then piecing together all the events in tandem. And then that game goes places as well. I thought it was going to be way more grounded than it was. Not to give everything away, but I mean, yeah, there are many reveals.
That's it. And there are, and those reveals are so weird sometimes that you don't expect them, that the game just kind of like does a great job of constantly subverting your expectations in a good way. And even when you think you understand who killed who and why, you'll eventually get to a scene that kind of like throws you through the loop, and then you might have to go back and revise one of your final answers for the cause of death of some of the crewmates. And that's great, you know, the idea of just giving you a brief snapshot, because all the game does is throw you into a static scene every single time you go into like one of these point of views. So you kind of like might get, you know, a guy who's holding a gun at another guy's head, and then, you know, you'll be able to freely look around that scene, look for things in the scene that might be significant, and then, like I say, try to piece them together when you get another scene further on down the line. That's a lot of uses of the word scene there, but that's just the subversion of expectations in that game is spectacular. It's so well put together.
I think as well, like, we could kind of use this to talk about like the idea of going through like a really good story once and being like experiencing it the first time, all the reveals, the plot twists, whatever it is, all the visuals and everything. That is obviously, you know, there's a lot of quality to that. But some of the best stories are better second time around, or can be, because you just get a greater appreciation for the craft overall. It's like, oh my God, they seeded that bit right at the beginning. I know it's the most obvious thing in the world, but I feel like we put so much of a premium on reactions and first time through stuff. That's kind of what we're talking about for the most part here. But I think sometimes something like Oberdin is so well crafted. Same with something like Papers, Please, even though it's not as like much of a direct narrative kind of thing. But I feel like something like Oberdin, like, it takes you on such a ride, but because it's such a, you can just hold that up as such a beautiful game, like, overall, and just give it to people and go, here you go, get lost in this, and get lost in all the different ways that things can be revealed, and it'll just work for you the same way.
I think you said something interesting there about like stories and putting a premium on like the first experience of those stories, and, you know, the stress of spoilers and whatnot. And I think that's kind of why I don't have many story games on my list right now, because I used to obsess over the first experience of something having to be perfect, whether it was games, whether it was movies. I'd get in my own head, and if I wasn't experiencing a movie I was looking forward to for the first time, I would convince myself it was ruined, and then I kind of unlocked the beauty of the second watch or the second playthrough in realizing that, thank God, a good story continues to resonate. It doesn't just make you cry one time. It will make you cry every single time if it is of a good quality.
Yes, sorry, I massively like to quote Jenova Chen, creator of Journey and various other games, Flower, and that one that we played, the Children of the Sky or whatever it's called.
On the Switch.
We flew around the clouds, it was lovely. That guy, he's had a quote where it's, you know, mature art ages with you, and I think the best experiences, the best core stories or core thematics or whatever they are, you'll get something out of them as you grow up and as you go back to it and as you appreciate it more. And to be honest, there is always that recency bias stuff as well. There is that whole caught up in the hype thing and then, you know, enjoying something a second time in a whole different way, just because your brain chemicals have calmed down a bit and you can kind of take it in a more rational way. We will have to wrap up this podcast, but I think collectively we've got some damn good games, and I think these are some of the best experiences that you can have first time through. So for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tailford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tailford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you next week, maybe with James Dowse.
Don't count on it. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.